Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hey there, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Better Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. And today we're diving into a topic that's really close to both our hearts. Viking armor. What's myth? What's reality? And what should you actually know as a cosplayer?
Great topic. And you're right in the thick of it when it comes to the scene.
Yeah. And what really stands out to me, Viking cosplay is everywhere right now. At conventions, at reenactment events, all over social media, obviously. And there are good reasons for that. Ever since Vikings, the TV series that started in 2013, interest in the Viking Age got a massive boost. Then came Assassin's Creed Valhalla, God of War Ragnarök. Shows, games, movies, Vikings everywhere. The topic is just incredibly present in pop culture.
And the exciting thing is that people don't just want to dress up. A lot of them really dive deep. They do their research. They want to understand what the materials looked like, how the armor was constructed. And that's exactly where authenticity comes into play. Historical accuracy makes a cosplay so much more immersive. It has a completely different depth compared to just throwing together some random fantasy costume.
I've noticed the same thing in the reenactment and LARP scene. Historical accuracy is increasingly valued, even at cosplay competitions. Craftsmanship quality and attention to detail factor directly into the judging at many contests. And if you can also show that you've really engaged with the historical background, the judges notice that.
And for that, you first need to understand what we're actually talking about. The Viking Age lasted from roughly 793 to 1066 AD, so nearly 300 years. And during that time, Vikings weren't just, how should I put it, the bearded raiders that Hollywood shows us.
No, the picture is much broader. Vikings were traders who operated routes from Scandinavia all the way to Constantinople and Baghdad. They were settlers who colonized Iceland and Greenland. They were farmers, craftsmen. In Hedeby, the major trading hub on the Schlei Inlet, excavations uncovered thousands of antler fragments used for comb production, the largest medieval antler waste deposit ever found. It was a full-blown manufacturing town.
And they weren't just trading with neighboring villages. Arab silver coins in Scandinavian graves. Silk from China. Amber exported southward. Walrus ivory from the Arctic heading into Europe. The trade network was enormous. And it's exactly that nuanced picture that makes Vikings as a subject so rich. There's so much more to it than axes and helmets.
The armor tells a story about the society behind it. Who could afford what? What materials were available? What the level of craftsmanship was like?
So let's look at the different types of armor we'll be covering today. It's really worth taking a closer look. Helmets. Chainmail. The question of leather armor. Shields. These are all categories where, as a cosplayer or reenactor, you can easily fall into the myth trap, if you're not careful.
And that's exactly what we want to save you from today. We'll go through each type of armor, look at what's archaeologically documented, what's more in the realm of fantasy, and what all of this means for practical implementation.
Because at the end of the day, it's about being able to make informed decisions. Whether it's for your next cosplay, for reenactment, or simply because you want to understand how Vikings really lived and fought. So, let's dive in. Let's start with helmets. because that's the very first thing most people associate with Vikings. Helmet with horns. And we both know that doesn't hold up historically.
The classic myth. It essentially goes back to the 19th century. Carl Emil Doepler designed around 500 costumes for the 1876 premiere of Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung in Bayreuth. He gave the Germanic characters winged and horned helmets. A purely artistic decision, not a historical one. That same year, an illustrated edition of Fritjof's Saga was published, with drawings by the Swedish painter August Malmström. From that point on, the image spread through all of popular culture.
Funnily enough, there actually were horned helmets in Scandinavia, but they date from the Bronze Age. The Viksø helmets from Denmark are dated to around 900 BC, so nearly 2,000 years before the Vikings. They had a ritual function. They weren't combat helmets. In battle, horns on a helmet would be completely counterproductive. An opponent could lever the helmet off, or a sword could get caught on them.
And when you look at what's actually been archaeologically confirmed, there's primarily the Jermundbu helmet. It was found in 1943 in a burial mound near Ringerike in Norway and dates from the second half of the 10th century. It's the only fully preserved Viking helmet we have, an iron helmet made of riveted plates with a nasal guard and the characteristic ocularia, a spectacle-shaped eye guard, which is why it's also called a spectacle helmet. Simple, functional, no ornamentation.
And the grave belonged to a wealthy warrior, likely an aristocrat. There were swords in there, axes, spears, even chainmail fragments. So the full kit of a high-ranking man. And even he had a simple, utilitarian helmet.
What's always fascinated me is there's only one fully preserved helmet. There are a few fragments from other sites. Tjele in Denmark, Lokrume on Gotland. But essentially, we're working with a single reference object for the entire Viking Age.
And that brings us straight to chainmail. It was one of the most effective forms of protective equipment in the Viking Age. In Old Norse, it's called brynja. The principle is thousands of small iron rings are linked together in what's known as a four-in-one pattern. So each ring is connected to four others. This creates a flexible armor that protects against sword strikes and arrows without severely restricting your movement.
And the effort involved is staggering. A chainmail shirt consists of an estimated 20,000 to 30,000 individual rings, depending on the size and sleeve length. The wire was hand-forged, wound around a mandrel, cut, then individually riveted or interlinked. That easily adds up to over 1,000 meters of wire. Some calculations put it at 2 kilometers or more.
And then there's the weight. A Finnish shirt typically weighed around 8 to 12 kilos. Depending on the size, sometimes a bit more. That sounds like a lot at first, but the weight is distributed fairly evenly across your shoulders and torso. Still, you're wearing that for hours in combat or on the march. It takes its toll.
And here's the crucial point. Not every Viking had chainmail like that. These were absolute luxury items. In sagas like the Njáls saga or Egil's saga, they're described as status symbols, imported or looted, often from Byzantium or the Frankish Empire. The cost probably equaled the value of several cattle. Exact figures are hard to verify, but it was definitely a small fortune.
By some estimates, only a small percentage of Viking warriors actually owned a chainmail shirt. Some historians cite figures below 5%. Archaeologically, only 5 to 10 fragments have been found across all of Scandinavia. That shows how rare these things were. Jarls, leaders, wealthy retainers. The average farmer who marched into battle had, at best, a padded tunic and a shield. The image of the fully armored Viking warrior, That's more the exception than the rule.
And by the way, if details like these fascinate you, feel free to leave a subscribe or a like. It really helps us produce more episodes like this one.
The materials of the Viking Age were generally used in a very purpose-driven way. Iron for helmets and chainmail because it offered the best protection. Wood was the material for shields, usually covered with rawhide or leather. Plus an iron boss, metal rims are not archaeologically documented, and leather was used for various pieces of equipment.
Although we should take a closer look at that in a moment, because the evidence for leather armor isn't quite as clear-cut. But that's a topic of its own.
In any case, you can clearly see from the materials this wasn't mass production. Every piece of equipment was handcrafted, individual, and extremely valuable. That also reflects the social structure. If you were well armored, you had resources, connections, trade.
That's what makes the practical implementation so appealing. When you're putting together a source-based Viking outfit, you have to ask yourself, what character am I portraying? A wealthy jarl with chainmail? Or a simple farmer who fights with whatever he has? Both are historically accurate, but the equipment looks completely different. Now it gets interesting, because with leather armor, we're entering territory that constantly sparks debates in the community. In blog posts and many depictions, leather armor is described as a lighter alternative to chainmail. Hardened leather, possibly reinforced with metal plates. And that sounds plausible at first.
It does. But archaeologically, the situation is far less certain than you'd think. And we need to be honest here. We have no direct finds of hardened leather armor from the Viking Age. None. Leather decomposes in the ground, unlike iron. Chainmail, helmets, sword parts, all of that survives for centuries. But organic material, like leather or textiles, breaks down in most soils within a few decades.
That means for cosplay and reenactment, leather armor is still a good choice, as long as you're aware of the limitation.
What we can derive from the sources points more toward padded undergarments. Gambeson-like tunics made from multiple layers of fabric or wool, possibly reinforced with leather. The classic Hollywood leather armor you know from TV shows that has little to do with what Vikings probably actually wore.
And that's a point cosplayers and reenactors should be aware of. There's a difference between historically verified and suitable for the scene. A leather armor piece can be outstanding craftsmanship, visually fitting, functional for the hobby. But you should be aware that you're working in a grey area. In reenactment groups with strict source requirements, that can become a problem. In cosplay or LARP, on the other hand, it's perfectly common.
And that's perfectly fine. You just need to know where you stand. If you want to go for an authentic portrayal, a padded wool tunic, maybe with some leather trim, would be the safer choice. If you want a cohesive overall look for an event or a photo shoot, then leather works.
Shields are a completely different story. They were the standard defensive tool of the Vikings. Round, made of wood. And the archaeological evidence here is really solid. The most famous finds come from the Gokstad ship in Norway, dated to around 900 AD. 64 shield remains were found there, made from lightweight softwood like spruce or fir, painted alternately yellow and black.
And the construction was... well, people always imagined them as being really hefty. In reality, the planks were only 5 to 8 millimeters thick. That's surprisingly thin. The typical diameter was 80 to 90 centimeters. An iron boss in the center to protect the hand. A wooden grip behind it. The whole thing was often covered with rawhide and etched with rawhide or leather around the rim.
And the thinness wasn't a disadvantage? 5 millimeters of wood sounds like nothing.
That's exactly the point. The Vikings didn't think of their shields as permanent equipment. They were expendable items. A shield would break in combat, and then you'd grab the next one. The sagas describe warriors bringing multiple spare shields into battle. Unlike chainmail, shields were affordable for practically everyone. Wood and leather were readily available. The production was manageable.
And that's exactly what made shields the cornerstone of Viking warfare. The shield wall, known in Old Norse as Skjaldborg, was the fundamental tactical formation. Warriors stood close together, shields overlapping, forming a solid front. Softwoods like spruce or fir were ideal for this because they were light and didn't splinter as badly as harder woods. When struck, the shield would absorb the blow rather than shatter into sharp pieces.
And that's a detail that's often overlooked. The choice of material wasn't random. Spruce, fir, regionally also linden. These were deliberate decisions.
And from practical experience, I can tell you, anyone who builds or buys a shield for reenactment today quickly notices that modern replicas are often significantly thicker and heavier than the originals. 13 millimeters of plywood is the standard thickness for reenactment shields. Historically, it was only about half of that. The Vikings had the balance between protection and mobility perfectly dialed in.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
The shield wasn't just a defensive weapon. It was also used offensively, for shoving, pushing, throwing the opponent off balance. That only works if you can maneuver the thing over an extended period.
Now let's get into the crafting side of things. And this is where I'm in my element. If you want to build your own Viking armor, you first need the right materials. For leather armor, the choice of leather is absolutely crucial. And the most common beginner mistake is leather that's too thin. If you use regular garment leather at 1 to 2 millimeters, it flops and bends in every direction. For armor components like braces or chest plates, you need at least 3, ideally 3.5 to 4 millimeters, of vegetable tanned cowhide.
And historically, leather was sometimes hardened through a process called cuir bouilli, basically treated in hot water or wax solutions. The leather becomes moldable, and when it dries, it gets really stiff and durable. The technique has been documented since antiquity, but as I mentioned earlier, with leather armor, we simply have no evidence that Vikings used cuir bouilli as body armor. As body protection, it didn't really become widespread until the 13th, 14th century. For the Vikings, it remains speculative.
The principle still works today. Some cosplayers experiment with beeswax as a hardening agent. But back to the actual process. You cut the leather to your desired shape, punch the holes for the rivets with a leather punch, and then it's assembled piece by piece with rivets. Cutting, punching, riveting, staining, embellishments. Those are the basic steps. For tools, you'll need leather punches, rivets, a decent hammer, and needle and thread for seams where rivets won't work.
And the staining is important for the look. Raw leather just looks like raw leather, light and uniform. Special leather stains give the material depth and color variation. Visually, that makes a huge difference.
Right, the next big challenge is chainmail production. And that's a whole different beast.
The 4-in-1 pattern sounds simple enough. Each ring is connected to 4 others. 5 rings per unit. Thread 4 closed ones onto an open one. Close it up, move on. But when you imagine doing that 20 to 30,000 times...
And the ring dimensions are critical. Many modern makers work with inner diameters of 6 to 9 millimeters using roughly 1 millimeter wire gauge. But that 1 millimeter is purely a modern standard. It's not archaeologically attested. In finds like the Tiefenau chainmail, you see more like 6 millimeters with thicker wire. The rule of thumb for the ratio is roughly 1/6 to 1/7. But there's room for variation. Wire that's too thin and the shirt tears apart. Too thick and the rings become nearly impossible to bend.
And then the question, riveted or just bent shut? Historically, the shirts mostly consisted of a mix of riveted and solid closed rings. You can see that in the famous Jermundbu find from Norway. Simply bending them shut wasn't done. Riveting holds much better. But it's extra work for every single ring. If you're doing it entirely by hand, you'll be spending many, many evenings on it. Some estimates put it at several hundred hours of labor for a complete shirt.
And that's also why many people today work with pre-punched rings that you can buy as raw material. The question then becomes more about steel or iron, plain or galvanized. But the weaving itself remains handwork, ring by ring.
And that really drives home why chainmail was so valuable in the Viking Age. It wasn't just the expensive material. It was, above all, hundreds of hours of a craftsman's labor.
There's just one last step that's often underestimated. The weathering. Because a freshly made piece of armor looks, well, fresh. And that's not what you want when you're portraying a battle-hardened Viking. For leather, mechanical aging works best. Going over the edges with fine sandpaper and over the spots that would naturally see wear. Knees, elbows, shoulders, then rubbing it with coffee or strong tea for an even patina.
And with metal, the same principle applies. Lightly scuff it up. Add scratches where they'd naturally occur. Some people use vinegar and salt for controlled rust spots. The trick is...
layered work. Not everything at once, but in multiple passes. First, a base patina. Then add targeted accents. If you slap on spray paint or overly uniform dark spots, it looks fake immediately. Nature never works uniformly.
And dirt and mud can go on at the end too, especially at events. It sounds trivial, but a set of armor that looks like it's been through a campaign, that just tells a story.
And that's exactly what makes it so rewarding. You're not just building a costume. You're building a character with a past. Every scratch, every mark tells a story.
But there's still quite a bit missing for the full picture. The armor alone doesn't make a Viking. Weapons are part of it too. And they didn't just have a practical purpose. They also had cultural significance. A sword, for example, wasn't just a weapon. It was a status symbol that often had its own name and was passed down through generations. Axes and spears, on the other hand, were everyday weapons. Far more common because they were much simpler to produce.
And spears are often underestimated. They were the most common offensive weapon of the Vikings. Cheaper than a sword, easy to make, and versatile. At range as a throwing weapon, in close combat as a thrusting weapon. Many warriors didn't even own a sword, but most of them had a spear.
Another important point is, of course, the accessories that round out the look. When it comes to jewelry, Thor's hammer, the Mjölnir, is obviously the most iconic piece.
Archaeologically, we know of around 50 silver examples from across Scandinavia, and hundreds in total when you include iron, bronze, tin and amber. Particularly noteworthy, Thor's hammer pendants increased sharply from the 10th century onward, presumably as a deliberate counterpart to the Christian cross. There are even casting molds that were used to produce both Thor's hammers and crosses at the same time.
The parallel to the cross is really fascinating. The hammer wasn't just jewelry, it was a statement, an identity marker in an era when society was caught between the old faith and Christianity. On the runic Thor's hammer from Köbeleu on Lolland, it even has an engraving that reads, "This is a hammer," completely explicit.
Besides Thor's hammer, Vikings also wore runic amulets, arm rings, brooches for fastening their cloaks. Materials included metal, bone, wood. These are all details that enormously elevate a cosplay. But then you can't forget the foundation, the clothing.
And that's actually something that's often neglected. You can be wearing the most beautiful armor, but if a cotton t-shirt is peeking out underneath, the whole illusion falls apart. Tunics and trousers made of wool or linen, plus a cloak. That was the basic wardrobe. And on the feet, turn shoes made of leather or simple boots.
With clothing, the same rule applies as with armor. Material choice is everything. Wool and linen are the historically correct fabrics. Cotton wasn't grown in Scandinavia and was extremely rare. And the colors were often more vibrant than you'd think. Plant-based dyes produced quite rich reds, blues, and yellows. The image of the dirty, brown-clad Viking is just as much a myth as the horned helmets.
And once everything's in place, the armor fits, the clothing works, the accessories are right, then of course you want to show it off. Cosplay events and conventions are the obvious choice. But reenactment groups also offer a fantastic opportunity to immerse yourself in the portrayal. There, it's less about individual presentation and more about the shared experience.
And a tip for photos? The environment makes an incredible difference. A forest, a beach, a meadow in the morning light. That conveys the atmosphere so much better than any studio backdrop. And best of all, during golden hour, that warm light just before sunset. It really makes the textures of leather and metal come alive.
And with that, we've really gotten to the heart of it. Whether it's cosplay, reenactment, or LARP, in the end, it's all about engaging with what you're portraying. The research, the understanding of the materials, the history behind it. That's what makes the difference between a costume and a portrayal.
And that's exactly why we love this topic so much. It connects craftsmanship, history, and passion. If this has gotten you interested in diving deeper, we highly recommend the blog at battlemerchant.com. You'll find lots more topics on historical equipment and Viking culture there. And in the shop, there's a huge selection to browse through, from helmets and chainmail to clothing and jewellery.
With that said, have fun building, researching, and portraying. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Until next time, take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.